Good morning. Sherry Minor McNamara, President and CEO of Chamber of Commerce Hawaii, looks ahead to the coming year. And East Oahu State Representative Gene Ward assesses the community's reaction to his online map of homeless communities in his district.
I'm Kathy Kozak. Creating a sustainable business model that is good for the community and the environment, combining unique forms of yoga and jujitsu? Well, we'll talk with Dewey Doan of the Kikoa Collective. And saving the corals in our oceans from death and destruction, we'll hear from Catherine Muzak from the Garden Isle.
It's Thursday, December 29th, and we'll have those conversations and a few more after the news. Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook and Dr. Kathy Kozak is with me this morning. Good morning, Kathy.
Good morning. Nice way to round out the year.
It is. And, you know, we're going to look at next year and maybe a little bit to look at the past in terms of Hawaii's business for our first conversation. Hawaii's Chamber of Commerce has a 165-year history, tracing its origins back to the California Gold Rush of the mid-19th century. The Gold Rush expanded a demand for Hawaii goods and services in an international arena that has never let up. Hawaii's isolation and the communications challenges of living in a chain of islands have put the Chamber in a unique position, and we're asking Sherry Minor McNamara, President and CEO of the Chamber, to look at where we are now. Good morning, Sherry.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm pretty good. I guess maybe the way to start out is ask you what kind of shape we're in now in terms of Hawaii's business.
You know, we're hearing from our members that they're clearly cautiously optimistic. Mm-hmm. We're hoping that 2017 will be a good year. But with that said, that's why we, the Chamber, continue to advocate for the business in many arenas, including at the state legislature, to ensure that the voice of business is heard and so that we can continue to ensure that our businesses thrive in our state.
What kind of wish list do you have for the coming legislative session, Sherry?
Well, each session we introduce a business package that focuses on three areas. One, spurring economic development. And under this pillar, our package includes bills that continue to promote our Manufacturing in Hawaii initiative, which we launched a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. The other pillar is focusing on cost of doing business. So we are having a bill introduced that addresses a specific area as it relates to employment. And in addition to that, as you are aware, each session there's thousands of bills that get introduced. And as a chamber, we review all those bills and identify those that impact business.
Sure.
And the other rare area is investing in our future, and that includes in early education. But in addition to the legislative arena, is also continuing our non-legislative initiatives. And one of the new initiatives this year that we worked on is strategic partnerships. And one of those is working with the University of Hawaii system in ensuring that we can improve our talent pipeline to prepare our future workforce.
Well, that's becoming more important as with each passing year, isn't it, that the jobs of the future are going to depend greatly on education.
Absolutely. And the type of positions are changing as well. So it's no longer a traditional position where, let's say, for example, a bank, and you are there in a traditional setting. And that's why you're seeing many businesses recreating the business environment and physical environment. Mm-hmm. As you heard, Bank of Hawaii is investing in the future banks. And so really, again, those types of jobs will continue to evolve. In addition, Hawaii has one of the lowest unemployment rates in the nation. And so, you know, there's always competition as it relates to the workforce. So we have to continue to train the future workforce to ensure that they are prepared for the ever-changing and involvement of these positions.
Sherry, I want to circle back to pillar number two that you cited, concerns about the cost of doing business in Hawaii. And, of course, those are concerns that come up year after year. What are the specific things that are most important to you folks?
Well, traditionally, the Chamber has not supported employment mandates, so anything that requires businesses to do. So those are the type of legislation that we are looking at. The other bill that we are looking at introducing, as we did last year, relates to the at-will employment doctrine.
What's that?
There was a Supreme Court case, state Supreme Court, that had a ruling, and the case was Adams versus CDM, and again, it changed the at-will doctrine. So in general, what it does is change the way employers can hire potential employees.
Could you just explain that a little bit further, the at-will doctrine? What's that?
So let's say, for example, the chamber is looking to hire someone under our marketing department.
Mm-hmm.
Generally, what happens is that the marketing department will review all the applications, interview them, provide phone interviews and in person, and then they recommend those, the final candidates, to interview with me and one other person.
Standard
under
practice,
this ruling,
yeah.
Pardon me? Yes, standard practice.
Uh-huh.
If for some reason one candidate did not get the position, because based on the employer's perspective, was not qualified for the position,
mm-hmm.
We would be liable, including the senior person who makes the final decision, even though that person did not interview in the initial hiring process of that specific prospect who did not get it and who did not make it in the first round.
You're vulnerable to getting sued by somebody you chose not to hire. Is that what you're saying?
Essentially. I mean, there's obviously more to it, but that's essentially it, without really knowing, without having been involved in the initial process, correct?
You also made a reference to employer mandates, and I'm assuming that things like minimum wage is one of those.
Generally, and I will say that a couple of years ago when the legislature did pass legislation, initially we were opposed to it, but we also understand the intent and the concerns of minimum wage. So we worked with the different stakeholders, and for us it was more about rather than a one-time huge increase, can we gradually have an incremental increase so that businesses can be prepared.
Where are we now, minimum wage, Sherry?
At this point, I know there's legislation that's going, that's possibly going to be introduced to, again, look at the $15 increase that other areas are also pushing and have done. And we have not taken a position yet. We need to look at the bills first before we take it back to our membership.
I'm assuming that would be somewhat of a burden, particularly on small businesses. That's the argument that's often advanced against mandatory minimum wage.
It is, absolutely. In Hawaii, most of our businesses, small businesses, and for the Chamber of Commerce, we have more than 80% as our members that come from the small business community. Mm-hmm. And so our job is to ensure that they can continue to be the job creators as well as continue to thrive and provide employment. And many of these costs, understandably, mandates do increase the cost of doing business and does impact small businesses.
Well, we're going to want to keep track of this in the year to come, Sherry, and so we'll keep in touch, okay? Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity.
Sherry Minor McNamara is President and CEO of the Chamber of Commerce Hawaii. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio at 8:15. Coming up, a business that's not all about making a buck, but first, here's your quiz.
Yesterday, we heard about an effort to increase Hawaii's use of electricity-powered ground transportation. With that in mind, we're looking at an electrifying tidbit of Hawaiian history in today's Backyard Quiz. Iolani Palace was the first location to make regular, prominent use of electricity in the Hawaiian Kingdom. 5 years after meeting Thomas Edison in New York, King David Kalakaua had an electrical system installed in the palace grounds. The plant consisted of a small steam engine and a dynamo for incandescent lamps. That was November 1886. The streets of Honolulu Town were illuminated by March 1888. A year after that, the first of a handful of residences and businesses had electricity. By 1890, the luxury had been extended to 797 of Honolulu's homes. However, there was another location in Hawaii, outside of Honolulu, that made small-scale use of electricity even before Iolani Palace. Can you name that location? If you can, call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. We might just light up your life with an HPR prize.
Aloha, I'm Boogie from Kailua. You're tuned in to HPR2, Hawaii Public Radio. Learn more about what you hear on the show at facebook.com/HIConversation.
How often do you hear of a business that measures their success based on their contributions to the local community, students, suppliers, and employees? Well, it's rare, but it's also the mantra of the Keikoa Collective, more than just a community store, but a gathering place for like minds who share a passion to work hard, play hard, and do good. Founder Dewey Doan is here to explain how to create a new version of the bottom line in business and life. Good morning, Dewey. Now, tell me a little bit about how you came up to create the Keikoa Collective. This kind of happened at a later stage in your life and yet has been potentially one of the most fulfilling things you've done.
This whole journey happened, I think, when I actually got laid off during the whole massive recession back in 2009.
Kind of the best thing that happened in retrospect.
Yeah, I think a lot of things in life happen like that, you know. So I was working for one of the most amazing surf companies for like 20 years and doing the downsize like everybody else. I lost my job. And when I kind of sitting there at home, have a lot of time reflecting back on, you know, my life, career, money, kids and all that, and you know, like anything else, I go, you know what? I got to look for another job. That's what we normally do. Our mind kicks in. You lose a job, you look for another job. So
sort
I did.
The American dream kind of fallacy a little bit.
Yeah. You know, because you're so used to, that's what you've done all your life. You know, you finish school, you go to work, you go to work, you go to work, you go to work and all that. And then when I got to work for other places, I just didn't find any fulfillment. I just find it was like something's missing. It's like I'm going to work. I'm not passionate about what I'm doing. I'm making a living, you know, but I'm not really living a life per se. And then, you know, our children was away for college. And then I look at my life, I look at my wife and go, what are we doing? You know, we're sitting here living in Orange County. And yes, you know, I'm going to work, I'm making money and all that. And I feel something's missing. And That's when Kakoa Collective came about. We started this brand back in 2009 when I started Jiu-Jitsu in 2007. And I fell in love with the gentle art. It was truly amazing. So back then when we started Kakoa, it was all about exposing the gentle art to the public. It was actually a beautiful thing. And since the layoff, the unemployment, I find that Kakoa was missing a lot of things, and one of them was purpose. So back then in 2009, we want to focus on jiu-jitsu. And then all those time I had been unemployed, I took a little deeper look into my life and kind of go, what am I really trying to do? Am I trying to sell T-shirt and make money, or am I going to make an impact in the world? So Aubrey and I, my best friend and I, kind of sat down together and kind of go, we're not finding any great work, any fulfillment in our job. We might as well take a risk and start this, relaunch Kakoa again and do something that was something we were really passionate about. And the passion we had was basically traveling, surfing, jiu-jitsu. And as of late, he started yoga and he really loves it. So yoga is now part of his deal. I started because my wife is a yoga fanatic, and I just started this year. Another thing we're fanatic about was, what are we doing that we can make a lasting impact and leave something behind where everyone can go, wow, if those guys started this company with this intention of changing the world and do good, maybe me as an owner or CEO can also do that,
Sort of to act as an inspiration, you've created this Kakoa Collective, and your idea is to use profits to help the community and to help the people at large, maybe inspire other groups to do something similar?
Yes. So a lot of times people ask, are you guys a nonprofit? I go, no, we're a profit for sure. But unlike other companies, we want to take our profit and use that money to create change in the community we do business in. And that's what we wanted to do. Rather than take the money and Aubrey and go buy big mansions and fancy Ferrari, that was not our goal.
Yeah, I think you're driving a little bit less than a Ferrari.
89 Volkswagen van, though. It's a German,
working,
though.
Hey, if it's working, you keep driving it. So you have this space down in Kaka'ako.
Right.
When people first walk into the space, it's not like a usual business. They're coming into essentially your home.
Yeah. And that was our intention. Our intention was, I didn't feel like the world needs another dum-dum retail store. But I feel community mindset was actually missing in most places. So we want to create like a living room or like somebody walk into our home. And that's what we did. And our space have couches, have a refrigerator, and has guitars, ukulele. It has all the component of my own personal space at home. So when you come in, a lot of time people are like, wow, what is this? It has a little room next door. It has mats, and it has, a little fountain. A lot of time they're like in shock. Like, what is this place? They didn't understand what it was.
Because you don't necessarily go right up to them and say, we're going to sell you something. Here's what you're going to buy.
Yeah.
It's a little bit different of a business model. There is stuff people could purchase should they want to, but there's also a space that they could enjoy. There's a place where they could do yoga.
Yeah.
I imagine they could do jiu-jitsu.
Right. So we actually, create space. Ideally, originally, was just actually for jiu-jitsu because I love it so much. And when Arby came up, approached it, what I've been hearing in the community these days, a lot of yoga teachers really having a tough time finding a space that can teach or that can make a living. A lot of yoga teachers in Hawaii, I guess, have five different jobs because they can really do yoga full time. So we thought about, hey, what if we take this space and use it as like a community space where these guys can come in, teach yoga. And they can actually make money, make a living, and kind of pursue that full time. So that's what we did. So the space is actually created so you can actually, between yoga classes, we have open mat for jiu-jitsu. And then we're not a school, so we kind of offer it to kind of introduction classes to the public so they can actually expose to it. And hopefully we send them back into the other jiu-jitsu academy where they live.
Well, and it's an attractive use of space. That one of the wonderful things about it is the fact that your business model is to give back to the community. Work hard, play hard, and do good. It's not the standard business model we hear about, but it sounds like it has really provided you with the most fulfilling way to use your time.
Yeah. I mean, right now, I feel like I'm coming to work, and when I see happy faces when they finish yoga and they walk out with just, the gleam in their eyes, and I just go, wow, this is the reason why I do what I do.
This is what it's all about. All right. Well, Dewey Doan has spent almost four decades working in the surf industry, majority of that time with Quiksilver as regional vice president. He founded the Keikoa Collective in 2009 and just opened up the first community store here in Honolulu last month. His passions are surfing, traveling, jiu-jitsu, and learning. Links to the Keikoa Collective are on our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation.
Think of how often you turn to Hawaii Public Radio for music, culture, and companionship. The station has been here for you every day, all year long. And before 2016 comes to a close, we urge you to make a tax-deductible gift to support the programming you enjoy. We gratefully acknowledge Joel Kosselbaum of Honolulu, Sandy Oku of Ka'ava, and Jennifer Watt of Kailua Kona for their generous support. Now it's your turn. You can call us at 955-8821 during business hours, or you can click donate at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Scheidler Family Foundation in support of the Honolulu Museum of Art, presenting Yun Fei Ji, The Intimate Universe, on view now through February 5th. HonoluluMuseum.org.
There's a new economy growing in Honolulu, and it's growing in one of the city's oldest districts. Chinatown, with its century-old buildings and its seedy history, may seem an unlikely locale for millennials, but its cheap rent and colorful past have their own allure, as Chad Blair reports in this morning's Reality Check. Good morning, Chad.
Good morning, Chris.
In some ways, doesn't this seem like kind of an unlikely pairing?
It does to me, and I'm grateful for Natanya Friedheim, our reporter, who's been looking at neighborhoods like Chinatown with sort of a new eye, a fresh look, because I guess you could say old-timers like me. You mentioned seedy parts of Chinatown, no question. I remember a number of bars that I would never even walk into. But what's happening is younger folks, particularly the millennial age, people in their 20s and 30s, many of them from the mainland, but also ones that have grown up here, moving into Chinatown in part because of the cheap rent. You know, it's a lot cheaper than the Ward area and sure, the Ala Moana area, no question about that. They love the fact that it's historic, but they also find it just flat out charming. There's the architecture. It's walkable. Yes, it is gritty, but some folks say they like that grittiness. They prefer that to a strip mall, and they're setting up businesses, particularly restaurants and media businesses, and they are making this a new dynamic. As you mentioned, a new economy there in Chinatown.
Well, that involves very likely that if you move into a facility in Chinatown, you're going to be doing some serious renovating, but also you're going to be bringing an entirely different population than the neighborhood has seen before. I would think that would be a challenge especially.
Well, Natanya says there's actually been a pretty good they're getting along, the older crew and the younger crew. The more established folks are welcoming the new blood because in a lot of ways they're very sensitive to other businesses, even though they may be competing. There's a lot of camaraderie, Natanya reports. There's also a new group that's been formed by these new folks called ACME, and it stands for Arts, Culture, Merchants, etc. That's what the E stands for. And what they're doing is they meet once a month to address things like the growing homeless problem, in Chinatown, which, as we all know, is a very serious thing. Well, that's something that I think every business can appreciate. As we also know, there's a lot of social service organizations in the area trying to help people in need. So that could be tough for business, but it shows that these younger folks want to help everybody make it a better neighborhood. And by the way, Chris, I should just mention, you still got the open produce and meat markets, and you still got the acupuncturist and the herbalist and so forth. Mm-hmm. So there's that part of Chinatown isn't changing.
So it's kind of the old and new juxtaposed. It certainly gives it no one would say it lacks character, Chad.
Absolutely not. It's sort of one person's compared it to New York City. They like the vibe and the bustle, and that's an interesting way to look at it. I hadn't really thought about looking at Chinatown in that way. A fresh set of eyes giving a fresh perspective on a very old neighborhood.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with a little vibe and bustle. Thanks a lot, Chad.
Thanks, Chris.
Chad Blair brings us a reality check every morning from Civil Beat. Hawaii Kai Representative Gene Ward has published a map of homeless encampments in his district, along with descriptions of some of the people who live in them, identifying one as mentally ill, another as a meth addict. As he told the Honolulu Star-Advertiser, "We know where they are and what they're doing. These people in homeless communities need to tell their friends that Hawaii Kai is not a friendly community." His map has been called everything from a helpful guide to people in need of help to an invitation to vigilantism, and he's with us to assess the community's reaction. Good morning, Representative Ward.
Good morning, Chris. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for coming in. What kind of reaction did you expect to
the first thing I expected, a half-hour interview with the Star Advertiser to be a little more balanced. The things that he didn't say was, you know, the constituent calls that I've received over the last 2 years was just reaching a crescendo, which when there were 20 people found in a Marina Association encampment, it just exploded. People were just demanding, you know, what are we doing about this? Where are all the people? So we talked to the police department, we talked to others where we found that there were more homeless in Hawaii Kai than we thought were, you know, occasional sandy beach, et cetera. So the map essentially was basically inventorying so we could outreach, i.e. give them services, food, whatever medicine they needed. And before you know you can do any of those things, you got to know where the people are. So the intention and the way that the advertiser spun it was like, hey, I'm violating or profiling or doing things unconstitutional. Basically, these people are doing illegal activities, and people wanted to know, particularly mothers with children, you know, should I be going to a place, particularly in Portlock, where there's a naked man on meth who's wielding knives? To me, it's a public safety and awareness. But the way that the article spun the map, it was like, you know, this is a vigilante call, and it made it in the worst possible light. So that's why I appreciate you bringing me in today to say the other side of what was not printed in that story.
Regardless of intention, a map of people who are considered undesirable in a community can get any number of reactions, including, you know, resentment, hostility, a kind of vigilante response perhaps unpredicted.
Only for the sake, though, that this is illegal activity. They were camping on private – 80% of the people there are on illegal camping positions, particularly Kamehameha Schools that has – well, they owned all the land in the beginning in Hawaii Kai, but 80% of all the people who are identified were on their land. And they go in and they evict them. So these were – people who were identified as doing illegal activity, some of them were starting fires in very dry areas. Some of them were endangering the neighborhood. So pointing out illegal activities, in fact, just so we're squeaky clean about this, I have just written to the Attorney General, Douglas Chin, saying, is there something in what we've done in this map that is constitutionally or otherwise not legal? And I will be able to respond to you or anyone else who thinks that maybe we've crossed the line into vigilantism or something like that. That was not the intent. That was the fabrication of the advertiser.
Well, intent aside, had you talked to HPD about saying I'm going to do a map, or did you seek an opinion from the Attorney General's office, for example?
Prior to that, I was putting it into the newsletters of which, as the representative of 15,000, at least in my email, yeah. was – to tell the people in Hawaii, particularly mothers with children, these are areas where you may not want to go. There are people who may be somebody that you want to keep your kids away from. And personally, in my own family experience, this, when my daughter was at the park and ride, excuse me, where the aside from dodging the feces and the smells of urine in the in that place, was suddenly with a homeless person jutting out in the bushes behind her, staring at her until she got on the bus. She said, "Dad, I'm really freaked out about this stuff." Well, so those are incidences of which, with the numerous calls that I got from constituents, with the people who are emailing me, and then with the Marine Association saying it took $80,000 to basically clean up after that 20-person camp on the section behind the Great Lawn, it was time to take an action. So we've got a, task force.
I don't think anyone would disagree about the effects of in an urban area of having a homeless community spring up and the kind of one-on-one encounters you have. I think some of the questions have been raised, for example, about the identification of someone as...
But Bennett, by name or photo? Chris, you got to say, if you identify them by name or by photo, sure, you're
that,
right.
That gets you around defamation?
Well, it gets you around that you're not doing anything illegal. And that's why I say I'm even asking the Attorney General. If what I've done is illegal, then the crime maps by HPD are illegal because they point out what happened on what street, what burglary, what car, what house, at least by street, was taken. And I did it by area without identifying anybody by name or with any photos.
There are presumably people in the community who are, you know, taxpayers and homeowners who also may be meth addicts, mentally ill, but they're not, they don't get identified because of that. And they might be, you know, in any community, there might be people who are of
They don't go naked and terrorize with knives as the person did in Portlock a few weeks ago.
Well, I don't think anybody would disagree about the difficulties of dealing with the homeless. It's the questions that have been raised about method and or even about the spirit of something like this. Was this a misquotation? We know where they are and what they're doing. We need to tell them that they're Hawaii is not a friendly community. Is that an accurate
quotation? No, it was where I was saying we had to first inventory before we did outreach. All the Connie Mitchell and the IHS referrals, he didn't do any of that reference. He just took stuff out of context and made it look like you guys are really the bad guys. And I should also admit that in our first homeless task force meeting, we invited the HPD because HPD wanted to say, you know, is this a group of vigilantes? And they cleared us. They had no problem whatsoever. We are cooperating with them as we are with Kamehameha Schools. So this is a kosher community activity. And, Chris, here's the big picture. This is not only for homeless in Hawaii Kai. We have got a whole legislative package that we're going to introduce so we can help other communities. Right now, there's never been a statewide solution to homelessness. There's never been even a managing possibility of it. It's been really,
what
really
are the solutions? Because that's what we haven't really addressed here.
In fact, what they are a series of bills that really try to manage homelessness, i.e. take it from being where Housing First, which is a $1 billion program if we really want to do it well, to where we can manage it by have, for example, legal places you can park and sleep. Right now it's illegal to sleep in your car. Illegal places where you can have campsites, where you can have services, hygienic and social services, where RVs or even trailers. You know, the word house trailer is like, what an anathema. But we've got to be able to house these people because it's so costly for the services. An ambulance ride is $1,000. We were talking to Connie Mitchell this morning, and she said that there's this, quote, million-dollar Murray who really started the Housing First issue when he went to the hospital so many times that it cost the emergency room and the ambulance services literally hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Oh, yeah, we've certainly heard ample evidence of that. I'd like to – I'm hoping that we can keep in touch with you as your legislative initiatives advance.
Yeah, we've got to stop kicking the can down the road in the legislature. We throw a few million here and a million there, but there's really not a solution. We've got 10,000 to 15,000 homeless. 4,500 are kids in the DOE, Chris. It's really a shame.
Well, can we resolve to keep in touch about that, Representative?
Thank you very much for having me today.
Gene Ward represents District 17 in the Hawaii State House. District 17 includes Hawaii Kai, Kalama Valley, and Oahu's Kaiwi Coast.
helping people.
It made me feel good.
Taking care of people.
It's just something that you want to do.
I wanted to help.
Hi, everyone. This is Bob Wehrman. It's time for The Benevolent Mind, our quest to discover the spark that ignites giving. Until the early 1820s, the Hawaiians had no written language. Everything was transmitted orally. When missionaries arrived, they saw the need to establish a written language, so they created one. After only a decade or so, the Hawaiians were among the most literate people on Earth. Hawaiian was the language of the land until the overthrow of Queen Liliuokalani. Soon after this, foreign interests tried to stamp it out. It was actually illegal to use Hawaiian in any state classroom until 1986. This is where Duane and Marty Steele enter our story. They saw that the native language was teetering on the edge of extinction and decided they could do something about it. So they turned to the Hawaii Community Foundation to focus their giving toward preserving the Hawaiian language. The Steeles helped publish some Hawaiian language books and are digitizing as many Hawaiian newspaper articles as possible. This attracted the attention of other philanthropists who joined in to save this ancient language. Our program is a production of Hawaii Public Radio and is sponsored by the Hawaii Community Foundation, believing for 100 years that philanthropy is all about you.
Tonight at 5, we have Town Square with guest host Neil Milner. Neil, you're going to talk a little bit about politics at the end of the year. Is that right?
That's right. We're going to do a politics end of the year review with Chuck Friedman. And Chuck Friedman is a longtime Democratic political strategist here. He worked in the Waiheke administration. He's had a variety of jobs here and is a really good person to talk to, both about how things work on the inside, and he has a very nice and broad perspective. So we'll be talking about the Trump election. We'll be talking about the future of the Democratic and Republican parties in Hawaii, and whatever else people want to talk about in politics. We think now that there is a little more information and a little bit more perspective on the 2016 presidential campaign than there was even 2 months ago, that'll be a good place to start our discussion.
Well, and there's certainly been a heightened awareness of politics and what really can happen if you don't participate in elections or even in your local community. We've learned some good lessons there.
Well, we've learned some good lessons, but there's also a whole lot of myths out there and a whole lot of anger and blame and, I think, misunderstandings about about what went on and why Trump got elected and why the Republicans did as well as they did. So it'll be a chance to kind of take people's emotions seriously, but also try to cut through them and explain some things.
All right. That's going to be today on Town Square at 5 o'clock.
Right. Thanks.
Thank you.
In today's quiz, we looked at the history of electricity in Hawaii. The later part of the 19th century saw sporadic use of electricity throughout the Hawaiian Islands. Sugar plantations became an early market for generating plants, too, primarily allowing for work to continue after dark. In 1890, operators of the Hilo Boarding School installed a water-driven dynamo on an irrigation ditch that was able to power 12 bare bulbs with direct current. It wasn't until the turn of the century that small electric companies began supporting sugar and coffee industries on the west side of Hawaii Island. On Kauai, Kauai Electric was incorporated in 1905 with the purpose of constructing a 2,400-kilowatt hydroelectric plant for McBride Sugar Company on the Waianae River. However, it was on Maui that the earliest adoption of electricity took place. In 1881, the Spreckles Sugar Mill in Sprecklesville on Maui's north shore powered lights by burning bagasse, the solid waste remains of burnt sugarcane. The lights were used to help increase nightly production. And it doesn't look as if anybody got that today, so we'll live to contest another day at 8:48. That's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Worldwide, coral reefs are dying, bleached away by a combination of warmer water, pollution, viruses, and more. But fighting against the loss of such an integral part of our aquatic environment, marine biologist Dr. Catherine Music has been transplanting coral in the reefs near her home on Kauai and hoping to combine both a project to save the corals with a public education campaign to help everyone realize their role in preserving the environment and the reef. Welcome to the conversation, Catherine.
Well, good morning. Thank you very much for inviting me. I love radio. So it's a very good morning. It's a beautiful day here in Kauai, a Goldilocks day, not too hot, not too cold, about 70 degrees Fahrenheit. So there.
Well, people all around the nation would be jealous of our beautiful weather and also of the beauty of the environment. Now, you had a special grant to be able to transplant coral last year, and you had some success.
I had to find the funds myself, but the permit was from the Department of Natural Resources, Department of Aquatic Resources. And so I was enabled with their permit to collect and transplant fragments of living coral. They're called corals of opportunity. So I'm not breaking corals. I just swim out and whatever I might find in the region that they gave me, I could select and put back into the reef.
And some of those corals lasted a little bit better than others. What happened with some of the types that you were transplanting?
I was originally given a permit for 6 species, but I only found 4 here, and 2 of them are rather massive ones. One of the problems with coral gardening in Hawaii is that our corals grow very slowly. There's been a lot of success in the Caribbean and the Philippines and Indonesia with a species that's a fast-growing branching coral. And so you can plant those and see results right away, but we don't have those. And I don't know. One of the problems I have when I pick up a rolling around coral is what its history is. So it's very important to keep observing and watching. When I started the project, I lost a few of the first ones, but as I roamed around for a year, the later ones were much more successful, so they were maybe more recently broken. So
now
it's cool. It's COOL, Corals of Opportunity and Love. So I did have a permit for 1 year, and I hope to continue monitoring the project.
You made a distinct differentiation of not breaking coral, and yet in some cases, breaking it can allow it to grow significantly faster than if we waited to have it do so on its own naturally.
That's right. And so if I do have a renewal of my permit, then I would like to, one, be able to break off coral branches that are part of a colony that's obviously deteriorating and dying for whatever reason. And that was part of your other question. Well, I don't know. I don't have enough experience here. I've only been on Kauai for 6 years. And so when I talk to people who are fishermen that used to be in the area, they are older now, and they were always focused on fish, not corals. So I don't have much of the history of this particular place. But, yes, in the Caribbean, they have shown, in Florida, for example, Dr. Vaughn, he breaks up coral, and it grows 25 times faster when it's broken than just planting it. So it's very interesting. The substrate here is part of our problem in Kauai and around the world. It's eroding, called bioerosion. The corals aren't growing as fast as the eroding elements are, which include contamination and global warming and also just the normal creatures that live there, like, you know, marine worms and sea cucumbers that are chewing up the reef as the corals are growing.
Now, long term, what would happen if we didn't have corals?
Oh, well, it's even short-term, in my opinion.
Unfortunately, yes, short-term it's happening.
Without the coral reefs, just as a protection against oncoming waves. They're a self-restoring barrier to the ocean, and so there's nothing that humans can do like that. They've been around much longer than we have. And so as they erode away, the waves that come in from the ocean pile up on the land and wash away this wonderful island, for example, and other places. So that's one. And the other is that they support or supported a lot of fish and other creatures, octopus and crabs and urchins that people eat. So I don't view them as a commodity, the reefs, but they're a geological formation and an important physical one, and then biological, they are the life of, they're the home of other sea creatures.
Now, part of what
the world.
Part of what you're able to do is not just go there to the ocean to do the monitoring of the corals, but also engage in a bit of public education. People may ask you, what are you doing? And then you explain what you're doing and explain to them
absolutely.
The importance.
Yes, I emphasize, I must. The most important aspect of this Mala Moana, which is Ocean Garden Project, is not about me swimming out to the reef to try to repair it. It's about educational outreach, especially to the students in the Kauai schools about the deteriorating conditions of reefs here. And also, because I'm right on the bike path on Kapa'a, then tourists and locals come by on skateboards and talk to me as I climb out of the ocean and think that there's a story here. So we talk. We have time. It's not like the bustling traffic on the other side. So, yes, I deeply want to share my understanding and my love of the ocean, and especially with the youth. Jaden, who's helping me at present, is only 17. I'm nearly 69. I'm 68, so that's 1/4 of my age, exactly. It's really important to have young people who are able, like Jaden, smart and capable, continue. And the only way you can understand this is to actually be there. As a child, I lived in Puerto Rico. I grew up there, and 60 years later, in my lifetime, the reefs have changed and are virtually collapsing everywhere. So it really is important to have the experience out there. I swim out and see the same little fish that I started observing 3 years ago. There's one little guy that's about, he was about 1 inch long, and now he's about 3 inches. He looks at me as I'm out there trying to find a place to put the coral down or see where my corals are. With my permit, I'm not allowed to put any markers out. I just can put the corals back.
And so, he's actually...
I'm just so happy. And there's a little fish going, well, what are you going to do today? And he's gotten bigger. And I have the same two turtles that I see often, perhaps habituating to me. They're like, oh, there she is again, you know. And I don't bother them. I don't touch anything except go out now to take photographs of
well, and
the
that's...
happy survivor.
That's what we need to do, is make sure that we document the corals and also do our best to try and help with the corals that are unfortunately being devastated worldwide. Thanks to entrepreneurial environmentalists like Catherine Muzak, the corals might just be saved. More information on her efforts on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
And thanks, Kathy. That's our show for today. On tomorrow's agenda, we'll talk with Daniel Martinez, chief historian at the USS Arizona Memorial, about the history of Japan-Hawaii relations.
Plus, we'll sit down with Kimmy Balmiero, Bollywood Project for Adults at MidPack Institute, and laugh a bit with the female comics of Hawaii.
We welcome your feedback on the stories we put on the air. Call us at our talkback line and leave us your comments. Here's the number, 808-792-8217. Email is talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. We're on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation, on Twitter at HI Conversation, or at BKOZHPR.
If you missed any of this show or you want to hear a past one, find them under the Conversation page with links to more information about guests and topics. Just look under Talk Shows for the Conversation on hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Kathy Kozak.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. Meet us in the morning for more of the Conversation.